Hello, I'm Kathleen Dunn. You are listening to the Ideas Network of Wisconsin Public Radio for this Tuesday, the 7th of July. Starting today, we're beginning a series of programs on healthcare. Not that we don't do many programs on healthcare all year, but this is a series that will be on Tuesdays at 10 o'clock for the next few weeks as we talk seriously about reforming healthcare in the United States. We thought it would be a good idea to look at healthcare in other parts of the world. What can we learn about how healthcare is delivered in places like Canada, in France, in the Caribbean? What about the history of healthcare reform in the United States? Are there ideas that we can use from other countries? Are there ideas that they have implemented that we just want to stay away from because they haven't worked very well in those countries? All of that on the table for the next few weeks. And we're going to start with Canada, probably more shows done by us on Canadian healthcare system than other countries, and a lot of debate about the Canadian healthcare system. They do beat us at life expectancy, infant mortality, obesity, and they spend less than half of what we do per capita on healthcare. There have been complaints about an emerging physician shortage, a longstanding problem of wait times in Canada, particularly for elective or specialist treatment, and an off-sited shortage of some specialized equipment like MRI machines. Joining us this hour to talk about healthcare in Canada is Professor Michael Orsini. He's joining us from the University of Ottawa, where he's on the Faculty of Social Sciences, School of Political Studies. And we'll be welcoming phone calls for him. And here's how you reach us. I would think we'll have many phone calls as we talk about what's going on with healthcare in Canada. Our phone number is 800-486-8655. 800-486-8655. And this may be a time you want to send an email, and you're always welcome to do that. That's talk@wpr.org. Talk@wpr.org. Professor Michael Orsini, hello. Thank you so much for being with us, too.
Hello, Kathleen.
Yeah, very nice to have you on the air.
Thank you.
So when you look at Canada's healthcare system, let's talk about what you like best about it that you think would transfer well to any kind of reform we do in the United States on healthcare. Is there something about your system that we don't have that's splendid?
Well, it's difficult to kind of cherry pick, I think, and to try to import solutions, Canadian solutions, onto the U.S. Case. But I think the most basic features of our system, or systems, I should say, is some form of universal care for physician and hospital, hospital services for all Canadians.
Mm-hmm.
And that's based on need and not ability to pay. I think that's whatever the criticisms, and there are many, and I'm happy to talk about them, at some fundamental level, we Canadians complain a lot about our healthcare system, but I think people are still pleased to have some form of universal care, and that means that they don't have to, pay out of pocket for those medically necessary services.
And you're rather proud of that as Canadians, aren't you, that people are covered?
Well, I think, I just spent the last 6 months in the U.S., so I've had an interesting kind of time in Seattle. I was on sabbatical, and many people kind of said the same thing to me, and they said, you must be very proud of your healthcare system. I think there is a bit of chest thumping, for sure. I don't think we should be overwhelmed in terms of our pride about our healthcare system, because there are some serious challenges. On the other hand, it is really one of those issues that divides Canada and the U.S., and that is our support for some form of universal health care. It's not socialized medicine, as a lot of our critics seem to suggest, but it is a form of, a health insurance system, which means that we all collectively pay. And I think that, for sure, is cause for some pride. What's interesting, I think, is that many people have used that difference between Canada and the U.S. to suggest that we are fundamentally different. And I think what's happened is that healthcare itself has become a value over time. And many people have pointed this out. I'm not the first person to suggest that. So it's not something that I think explains why we have such a different healthcare system. It has become part of what distinguishes us in some way over time, over the last 40 years or so.
It's been 40 years now you've had this system?
A little over. I mean, it started off in the province of Saskatchewan and then kind of in fits and starts across the country in different provinces. And then we saw a more uniform basket of services offered throughout the country in each province. But so we have, as Canadians, we have been thinking a lot about reform, and we've had, you know, we call them royal commissions. I'm not sure what you would call them in the U.S. context, but basically lots of money thrown by the federal government at, you know, allowing people to talk about what to do. You know, it's this perennial Canadian solution to anything. And we've recognized challenges, but we've also seen, I think, from in poll after poll after poll, that it's really one of the values Canadians hold dear.
Mm-hmm. And what do you call it? Do you call it Medicare? Do you call it a single-payer system? What is it?
We call it Medicare, so that's to distinguish it from what you call Medicare in the U.S., for sure. But we also, there has to be some precision with respect to calling it a single national system. We don't have a single national system in Canada. It's one of those misnomers or myths that needs to be kind of cleared up, I think, in off the top. We have different systems from province to province. And we have, in Canada, as of 1984, something called the Canada Health Act, which is our health legislation, if you will, at the federal level, that tries to, at some point, make sure that people in one province are getting the same type or level of service and care than they are in another province.
I see. And how do you accomplish that?
Well, with some great difficulty, I think. what happens is that the federal government transfers money to all the provinces for health care. And really, health care is pretty much a provincial responsibility in Canada. And then when provinces have to periodically show the federal government that their spending has upheld and not contravened the principles underlined in the Canada Health Act. So the Canada Health Act being this federal legislation. So, and if they flout these rules or principles, then they can be penalized.
Mm-hmm.
So it's a bit of a carrot and stick, I guess, if you will. And one of the main things that our Canada Health Act says is that, a couple of things, but that physicians can't extra bill. So for services that are offered in the public system, they can't say, well, I'm a really fantastic doctor, so the ability to see me through the public system means you should pay a premium of $50 or $75 extra. You can't do that according to this Canada Health Act. And user fees are not permitted. So there are, among other things. But these are ways in which the federal government tries to attach some strings to its funding of health care.
I see.
I'm sorry if that, it sometimes sounds very, very complicated. And I mean, as someone who tries to teach this at the undergraduate level, it can get a bit confusing.
No, it's nowhere near as confusing as what we got going on here. So I think that we're catching on to it pretty well. Why is it that your healthcare system, you spend less than half of what we spend in America per capita on healthcare? I don't understand that. Why is that?
It is significant. I think we're pretty much on par with other OECD countries, I think, in terms of spending. I think it's what has to be explained is why the U.S. costs are so high per capita. And I think that has to do, in some cases, with the kind of administrative costs that are attached as well. But I don't know. We don't cover everything, right, through our public system. And it's important to stress that as well, that the universal health care that Canadians receive doesn't cover everything, and in many cases, about 30% is covered privately, and that's oftentimes through an employer, for instance. So, you know, drugs, for instance, would not be covered, and you'd have to pay for that out of pocket unless you're indigent or qualify for certain programs. So, but it is one of those scratching the head type of factoids, I think, that gets tossed out and is for many people is confusing. That how can we do so much with so little? I think the short answer is that there are certainly areas in which we can improve as well. So that cost per capita is lower, but it's not paying for everything.
Mm-hmm.
But certainly it points to some great inefficiency in the U.S. In the U.S. system. There's no question.
Right. Oh, it certainly
and,
does.
And for me as well, as somebody from watching from the outside, this idea that 45 or 46 million people are uninsured or underinsured, the underinsured part is important as well, and still we see these costs so high is really bewildering.
Mm-hmm. When you talk about the services that are not covered, why don't you be more explicit? What is covered? What is not covered?
Well, hospital and physician services are covered, and they have to be deemed medically necessary. And in that case, I'd say about 70% of spending is within that public system, and the 30% that's not normally is again drugs, dental care, eye care would not be covered. In some cases, home care would not. In many cases, home care would not be covered. So you would have to have access to a private plan through your employer, or purchasing some form of insurance to cover that, and it's significant. It's still a significant part. So, again, one of those myths we need to sort of bust, I think, is this idea that we have a complete, that our system is entirely public. It's not. We also have, for instance, there was a bit of a kerfuffle here in Canada when it was revealed that the leader of the New Democratic Party, which is a left-of-center party in Canada, had hernia surgery at a private clinic in Canada. So this was seen as somehow a little questionable for somebody a party that traditionally has supported the public system. And it was revealed, and it was very clear that this clinic offers hernia surgery, a state-of-the-art clinic, and it's a private clinic, but it's paid for through the public system.
Oh.
So he wasn't doing anything wrong.
Huh.
But his political opponents tried to make some hay of that. So that's the other part of this, is we have a system that's publicly administered that doesn't necessarily outlaw private care.
I see. And when it comes to being able to get insurance for dental, for eyes, et cetera, do most companies offer private plans, or are most people on their own for paying those services completely?
Most people are covered. I mean, the problems of people being uninsured pale in comparison to what we see in the U.S. context, for sure. And I think where you would see it is people who might be self-employed or working in a small firm or what have you, with a few employees, where there's no plan per se. But generally, people who are receiving social assistance in Canada would have those kinds of costs covered. People who are Aboriginal people in Canada who are generally very, very low income, very poor health outcomes are covered. There are plans that cover them for those services that are not paid through, that are not covered under the public system. So we have a number of safety nets, if you will.
Mm-hmm.
Without painting too rosy a portrait, I don't want to do that as well. But
right.
Yeah.
And I would imagine there are attempts to have those kinds of services included in Medicare.
There are, and we've had something called what they call delisting of services. So initially, an eye appointment was something that you could have covered. It was a $50 charge or what have you, and provinces began to delist some things. So if you're going for an eye appointment, that $50 is coming out of pocket. It's not covered anymore. There has been some attention to this idea of providing some form of what we called pharmacare, but a program to cover prescription drugs, especially given the skyrocketing costs of those. That hasn't really it's picked up and then it's waned, as many issues do, in Canada, and I think it's been overtaken, and I'm not sure if we're going to get a chance to talk about this, but it's been overtaken by the question about wait times for surgeries mm-hmm. and for services, which has become the mm-hmm. issue dominating the landscape over the last little while since 2005, actually.
Yeah, well, let's talk about that issue, because I'm sure we'll hear from listeners that that's the main criticism that we hear of Canadian system. Oh, the wait lines are terrible, particularly for elective and specialist treatment, and those mm-hmm. who have come to the United States to have treatment done.
Sure. I mean, and this is another one where we can't, I think, paint too rosy a portrait, but certainly the wait times issue is a real issue, and especially real for people who are waiting for a hip replacement or what have you. I don't want to diminish that importance of that. But I think my sense has been that the way it's been addressed in the last little while has been kind of obscured all the other issues that are really, really fundamental. So even the idea of wait times suggests that you can find some way to measure the quality of healthcare. And for many people, the idea of a wait list for a surgery that was 12 months being reduced to 6 months, that would suggest some very serious improvement. And I guess my fear there is that it might send the wrong impression, and that somehow simply reducing the wait list for a particular surgery is going to solve all the problems that are still there. Not to mention the fact that provinces in Canada have been playing a bit more fast and loose, I guess, with this idea of when somebody is on a waiting list. So you could technically say that, well, they weren't on the waiting list till January, therefore they only waited 4 months, when in fact they didn't put them on the wait list till January. They were floating somewhere for a little while. Mm. So you can see how mm-hmm. people find, I guess, creative ways to kind of fudge the numbers. So I'm not suggesting any one particular province did that, but it's a real issue about what constitutes a reasonable wait time, and that would vary as well. And this is not unfamiliar in the U.S. as well, but certainly Montreal and Toronto and Vancouver, being three major hubs, are well staffed in terms of specialist services and what have you, big hospitals. Other cities, not so much. So is it reasonable to wait 6 months in one city and 6 months in a more remote region of the country? You can see how that can become right. very difficult to manage and to find some uniformity across the country. We're a pretty vast, very vast country.
Yes, you are. Do you have to have the services done in your province?
Generally, that's what happens. I think what will be interesting in the next little while is whether the pressure on reducing wait times will mean that provinces will find other ways to provide patients with those services or that care in another province. And that, I think, might be an issue that's on the horizon. It happens, certainly, but you can imagine that the costs associated with that can be quite high. We see that in the case with Aboriginal people, for instance, who live in remote regions. They don't have access to care where they live. So the region in question has to find a way to provide that care, and that often means flying them out to different regions of the country where there is access to those services. So, and that's a way of kind of saying, in the Canadian way that we talk about some collective responsibility, that you shouldn't be penalized for living in one part of the country mm-hmm. that is less resourced or not as resourced or well-resourced in terms of medical staff and services and that kind of thing. Mm-hmm. So there is a recognition that not all provinces or regions are created equally, if you know what I mean.
Right. And who would maybe people who have done this, who would be coming to the United States to partake of our healthcare system? Would it be people who do have a lot of money and don't want to wait for those services like a hip replacement?
Generally, I think. It's difficult to generalize, but what I seem to hear more of in terms of this movement around medical tourism, I think they call it now, is people leaving, going to places like India, where you can build in, it's a one-week and all-inclusive type of thing that includes pre-care and aftercare, and is relatively affordable if you can get past the idea of flying, being on a flight for X number of hours.
Yes.
So, but I guess that's the fear that's often expressed, is that opening up a system to more private care will really only advantage the people who are already privileged in our system, the people who have that ability, who have no financial issues or impediments or obstacles in their way, and certainly that would run counter to this idea that the need should dictate, not the ability to pay.
We're going to welcome phone calls. Professor Michael Orsini is our guest this hour. We begin a series of programs starting today on healthcare in various parts of the world to see if there are ideas that might work well here in the United States as we debate this issue pretty heavily this summer. He is associate professor, faculty of social sciences, School of Political Studies at the University of Ottawa. He's a political scientist and a former newspaper reporter whose research interests include health policy and politics. And as you heard him say, he teaches the healthcare system to undergraduate students at the university. Our phone number is 800-486-8655, 800-486-8655. Our email is talk@wpr.org, and this is the Ideas Network of Wisconsin Public Radio. We go to phone calls now for Professor Michael Orsini, and let's start our calls with Marty from Douglas County. Hi, Marty.
Hi, good morning, Kathleen. A friend and I were in Canada recently, and we decided that since there is all of this confusion about what exactly the healthcare system there is all about, we just sort of stopped people in our travels and said, what do you think of healthcare in Canada? And to a person, they all thought it was fabulous. We were in line in the grocery store and buying gasoline, and it was in the province of Ontario, so I guess it was a sort of narrow survey, but the comment that we found most poignant was a waitress who had had breast cancer. She'd had a mastectomy. She said, you know, of all the things I had to worry about, paying for this was not one of them. And most people know that the connection between stress and health is very strong. I would imagine that not having to worry about how you're paying for your major health care in Canada, the stress of not having to worry about how you're going to pay for it is helping people heal faster. Mm-hmm. And on the issue of waiting for services, the way she explained it, and I'm hoping the professor can clarify this, she said because she had to get in to see this physician, this surgeon for her mastectomy, someone who was on the list for, say, breast reduction surgery got bumped to the next month. That the surgeries that are most imminently important take precedence over the ones that are less so.
Professor?
Yeah. There is a system of triage, absolutely, in our system. And what's important there, too, is that, as has been pointed out, physicians make those decisions versus in a private insurer versus, you know, this idea that somehow big bad government is making these decisions. No government person makes decisions like that. Those are based, and while people might quibble sometimes with physicians' decisions, what many people are pleased about is that normally they're not encumbered by those kinds of cost considerations. They're supposed to be concerned primarily with care, and the person with breast cancer would take precedence over someone looking for breast reduction service surgery. So, but the other thing that caller raises that I think is really interesting is, and I'm glad that it's raised, is this link between health and social policy, I guess is what I would call it. There's what I've seen in the U.S., and again, my limited experience having lived in the U.S. for a short time, is that the discussion about health care reform has really moved along absent, and what's been absent from that discussion is how health care reform cannot occur in a vacuum. There has to be some consideration of that social policy, how to deal with issues such as poverty, and there's a lot of research linking, for instance, poverty, low income, to heart problems, and that sort of suggests that there's a link, a pretty strong link between that kind of psychic stress that's related to having difficulty earning a living, covering bills, food, clothing, and shelter, and health underlying health problems. And my fear, I guess, is that some of the discussion around healthcare reform misses, that doesn't acknowledge that you can't, that it's not the whole story, I guess, that the reform piece is not the whole story. I guess I'm still surprised that that's not something that that has moved to the fore.
Right. That phrase that you used, we hear occasionally here, but it doesn't guide us, and that's collective responsibility.
Yeah, in Canada we talk about the mantra. I'm not sure what you talk about in the U.S., but we talk about the social determinants of health.
Mm-hmm.
So we say that health care, and again, this is a tricky one to argue, of course, because I was talking to some people in the U.S. who said, well, we don't want to say that health care is not the only thing that improves people's health, because we want health care reform. And of course, I accept that, but it's health care alone is not sufficient if we don't attack issues such as income inequality and increasing polarization around income. It's not just income inequality. It's that the people earning the most and the people earning the least, that gulf has expanded considerably. And we know that that produces poor health. So there's this recognition in Canada, although there's still work to do, that we have to tackle those issues as well. And not only focus on health care reform, but maybe that's a luxury that we can afford to discuss because we have some form of universal health insurance. But I just think that it's in the U.S. context, it's particularly striking to me that it's not discussed with the same kind of fervor.
Thanks very much, Marty, for your call. We go next to Tom from Campbellsport. Hi, Tom.
Hi. I just have some anecdotal information. In the mid-90s, my mother-in-law, who's Canadian, had a stroke, went to Montreal General Hospital, and we went, different members of the family went to be with her. She was in the hospital 3 months. And it was striking, first of all, that there was no grand lobby. The entrance was rather drab. The hospital looked drab.
It still is drab.
But it was sort of no frills in appearance, but the healthcare, the nursing care particularly, was excellent.
Mm.
It was respectful, considerate, very frequent. There were lots of aides. It just was, it compared very, very favorably with nursing care in the United States. And I've not only had experience with my own family, but I'm a pastor, so I've had a lot of experience with people in hospitals in the Milwaukee area. And one other feature of this is that she was allowed to stay in the hospital for 3 months. Finally, she couldn't swallow. She refused a stomach tube for feeding, and then she died. But they didn't rush her out of the hospital. That was a circumstance with same circumstances prevailed with other people that were in the room, because it wasn't a private room. Mm. That they were given a lot of consideration as to how long they could be there. They weren't rushed out. She wasn't shipped off to a nursing home, and it was just the nursing and health care provided for her were impressive.
Hmm.
Professor, you want to respond?
I'm sad to report, however, that what we've seen in the last probably decade or so, and I think you mentioned, the caller mentioned that it was in sort of early, mid-90s, there has been a shift in Quebec, my home, where I was born, Montreal, actually, there has been a shift toward what they call ambulatory care, and that means that the one of the primary goals now is moving people out of hospitals quicker. So I'm not sure if in 2009, if that same situation would have occurred where a person would not be pushed out or rushed out of the hospital. What people have commented about and criticized is that if we want to move health care outside of the hospital setting, which is perfectly acceptable, there has to be some support, financial support, and for that care when it moves into the home setting. So whether that be nursing care and respite care for families who are doing that. And what many people have pointed out, I think quite rightly, is that this shift toward moving hospital-based care, moving away from hospital-based care, has been borne mainly by women in the home who perform the majority of that kind of what they call care work. So that's an important part of this debate in Canada as well, is it's all fine and well to say that people shouldn't spend too much time in hospitals if they don't need to, but who the heck is going to take care of them when they leave the hospital?
Right. Thanks very much for the call. How do you deal with end-of-life issues in Canada? Blood transfusions at the end of life, very expensive procedures when the prognosis is not very good for much life left.
We struggle with that as well. I mean, we've struggled with in cases where I recall a case in the province of, I believe it was Nova Scotia in the eastern part of the country, where someone had a genetic disorder that required a particular medication that was extremely costly, in the neighborhood of $400,000 a year, I believe. And there was a committee that was formed at the level of the hospital to kind of really reflect on whether, in a province with fewer resources than a province like Quebec or Ontario or British Columbia, whether that was a good use of taxpayers' dollars to say we're going to support medication for someone who has a genetic disorder, and that person might not live very long anyway. So I believe in that case, the decision was, if I'm not mistaken, not to support that, but partly because I think the drugs were in the experimental phase, so that was a convenient way, I guess, for the provincial plan to say, I'm sorry, we can't cover this. But we certainly grapple with those issues. That's not something that we as Canadians have been able to figure out, because I think they're so complex and they're so specific to that particular case that it's very difficult to sort of say there's any kind of criteria we could establish that would apply across the cases. I think it becomes more poignant and especially difficult to deal with when one involves children, for instance.
Right. Oh, yes.
In terms of end of life, we've had our own difficulties around euthanasia and what have you.
Mm-hmm.
Certainly.
Bob from Stevens Point, hi.
I heard an anecdotal story of a Canadian who said he lived 30 minutes from two hospitals in Detroit where he could get needed treatment. I think it was a cancer of sorts. And he says the government kind of gave in Buffalo. Well, but the point being, if they give permission, I'm not talking about people who go to Florida for the winter, but if they give permission, is the Canadian government paying something for that?
If they give, I would assume so. I mean, I think one issue that's come up recently in the province of Quebec, I don't think I've mentioned it earlier, was a big Supreme Court case decision that kind of opened Pandora's box, let the genie out of the bottle, what have you, with regard to whether people who are waiting for services, if they're waiting in the public system, whether they should be allowed to access that care in the private system. That could include going to the U.S. That could include going to another province. And what has really frightened provincial governments is this idea that, well, if we don't provide that care in our public system, are we on the hook to pay? And my sense is that the Supreme Court was careful about this, but my sense is that if you establish what you think is a reasonable wait time for a particular surgery or service, then yes, the provincial government would be on the hook and would have to pay wherever that person got that care,
mm-hmm.
whether that's in Canada or in the U.S. And I think that's the $64,000 question in the Canadian context: is how far can states, can governments, provincial governments go in terms of providing that care wherever that care is needed, wherever that care is offered?
Do your doctors make about the same as American doctors, less, more?
I think they make a little less. I mean, certainly specialists do fairly well in Canada just as well as they do in the U.S. But I think just as in the U.S. context, you know, physicians are among the most well-paid in the country. There's no question.
And
better
what,
paid than professors, that's for sure.
What about shortage of physicians? We've had a problem with specialists being well-paid, but primary care physicians not making as much and not locating
yes.
themselves in rural areas, et cetera. Is that a
that's
problem?
That's an issue. Absolutely, that's an issue in Canada. We do have, some people quibble with this, but we do have a bit of an issue with respect to physician shortages and also in terms of nursing, certainly. we have a lot of nurses who flee Canada to the U.S. for greener pastures and great better salaries. There's no question. Mm-hmm. But and this is where the debate about the public and private becomes fairly interesting, because the argument that's often advanced around including or increasing the level of private care in Canada suggests that it would ease the burden on the public system. So if I'm waiting for surgery in the public system, letting that person who has the means go to the private system will mean that I jump up the queue. And of course, you know, physicians can't be in two places at the same time. So the fear is that you don't, you know, those few physicians that are in the system, if they opt out and move into the private system, it's going to actually decrease. It's going to actually increase the weight in the public system, not decrease it. So there is what, you know, economists call an inelastic supply of physicians. We can't just produce them magically out of thin air. They need to be trained. The training is long. The training is costly.
Sure.
So what we've had in Canada as well is some attempt to say, well, there are certain shortages in certain parts of the country, and we need to sort of encourage people, physicians, to move to those places, particularly northern regions of the country. So there are attempts to say, well, if you promise to hang out there for 5 years, we'll cover your tuition or offer some sort of incentive structure.
And that's working?
It's just begun recently, I think, but certainly that's one way. But, you know, the physician shortage issue is not a problem that can be dealt with overnight. I think that'll take several years. But there's no question that part of this is difficult to address, because how do you, you know, I guess, force physicians to choose one option over another, to say that, you know, it's okay to be a family physician versus a specialist, when within the profession itself there are clear incentives, financial incentives and reputational incentives, to seek out a career as a specialist versus as a family physician. So mm-hmm. I think that's a harder one to address.
Mm-hmm. More phone calls in a moment. Today we are beginning a series of programs on healthcare in other countries. And are there certain parts of plans of other countries that we may want to seriously consider as we reform or attempt to reform America's healthcare system? Professor Michael Orsini is our guest, Associate Professor, Faculty of Social Sciences, School of Political Studies at the University of Ottawa, where he teaches courses in healthcare systems. His research interests include health policy and politics. We have one line open. It's been a busy hour, so take the line if you'd like it, 800-486-8655. I'm Kathleen Dunn. This is the Ideas Network of Wisconsin Public Radio. We return to phone calls now, and let's go to Connie from Duluth. Hello, Connie.
Hello. I live in British Columbia, and I'd like to just share some of my practical experience with the healthcare there. One thing is that as a senior, I pay $52 per month for all care that I get, that's medical, not eye care or anything like that. And at one time I cut a tendon in my hand. I had surgery and had no charges whatsoever.
Hmm.
And then the other thing that I really appreciate is we have medical drop-in centers in most of the malls there, and you can go and get your flu shot and get yourself tweaked here and there when everyone needs it with no charge. And I have friends that get $100 from the government to pay for their children's athletic equipment each year, because it's part of the theory of, you know, keeping people healthy.
Really?
I wanted to just share that with you. Thank you.
Thank you. Thanks, Connie, very much for the call.
Yeah, but if I might add, Kathleen, I'm not sure. I think that preventative care, too, is another, certainly an important issue that with varying degrees of success, I think provinces have been trying to put in place strategies to ensure that people who might access the system could find, perhaps through a clinic and not necessarily a hospital-based setting, the kind of support that they need, as well, you know, especially with issues such as, you know, diabetes and and those kinds of chronic care issues becoming extremely important and costly for the healthcare system. So that's certainly an issue that's on the radar in, mm-hmm. in the Canadian context.
Thanks for the call, Connie. Jerry from Appleton. Hi.
Good morning.
Hi.
I have been listening, not for the entire show, but what I've heard so far is a discussion of an attempt to get people covered because there's 40 or 50 million Americans who are not covered by health insurance. And if we could only do that, which is a very equitable thing to do, then things will be fine, in a sense. But when I look around, I see people who have excellent health care coverage, people who work for the state, for the county, for the cities, for unions, for the military. There are many, many, many of them who are not in good health. And most, I mean, first of all, we know that more than 50% of all healthcare costs are due to lifestyle choices. So even people who are insured have all these lifestyle issues that somehow the medical system doesn't treat. So what we're doing now, I think, is discussing how can we get 50 million people to join a medical care system, at least supposedly have better access to it, that isn't very good in the first place. Now, I'm not saying that it's a terrible system, but when you look at worldwide statistics, we find that the United States ranks nowhere near the top of for anything like longevity or anything you can think of. So why are we talking about the inputs to the medical care system when those inputs don't really seem to give us a desired output, better health?
Professor Orsini?
I certainly would agree, and I think that's why we need to be careful that the issue of health care reform, it doesn't overshadow everything else that has to happen. I would be a little careful to simply suggest that lifestyle changes are solely responsible. I think even lifestyle factors need to be contextualized, I guess. I think it's important to understand why people engage in certain behaviors and whether those behaviors are rational or whether they choose to do certain things. There's been interesting research even on looking at why people make poor health choices in terms of their food and their intake, and they found in certain parts of the U.S. and in Canada that there are places in which it's virtually impossible to find fresh fruit and vegetables in low-income neighborhoods. So it's not as simple as suggesting that it's the lifestyle behavior itself, but really looking at what produces that behavior in the first place. So I think it's fair to say that it's healthcare reform is not a panacea, but it's certainly, I think, a step in the right direction. But the preventative piece is there's no question it's critical, and chronic illness is the sleeping giant in Canada and in the U.S. There's mm-hmm. no question there.
Thanks for the call, Jerry. Carl from Beaver Dam is next. Hi, Carl.
Hi. I was wondering if the professor has any ideas about this. To me, it's a huge disconnect that the U.S. is by far the most church-going nation among all developed nations. Nobody comes close to us. And yet we're the only one that doesn't provide universal coverage for our citizens. And to me, that's just a huge disconnect. You'd think we'd be the first one that would have done it. And yet we're still dragging our feet. Does your guest have any ideas on that?
Ooh, I'm not sure. I'd venture to guess whether there's a link between church-going, church attendance, and religiosity, but certainly I think it's sometimes a bit of a lazy, intellectually lazy way to describe the difference. But the idea of this rugged individualism that is at the core of America somehow explains, I think, this idea that it's important for people. The responsibility for your health is your own, and it's not something that government should provide or offer. So I think that might have something to do with it. I think the other critical factor, it's been pointed out by a colleague of mine in a really interesting book, a colleague named Gerard Boychuk, is the race issue. I think that is a way of I think we need to think a little more clearly about how race has really structured the debate in the last little while, and how, in many cases, even in the South, there was fear that African Americans would be covered by certain insurance schemes. So that to me is an issue. I'm not sure where religion fits into that discussion, but it does seem a little odd that that there would be less of a collective sense of responsibility than especially expressed among people with good family values, for sure.
Mm-hmm. What's your friend's name who wrote the book?
Gerard Boychuk, Boychuk, and he wrote a book called National Health Insurance in Canada and the U.S.
Great.
I'm happy to provide a link to that, an email with a link to the book. It's a great book that really challenges conventional wisdom, I think, on some of these issues.
Yes, it sounds very interesting. Fine, yeah. If you'll provide the link, and then we'll put it on our website.
Absolutely.
That would be marvelous. Was it a big deal in Canada to have Medicare? I mean, was this a huge debate? And
oh, yeah. I'm glad you asked that, because I think there's a tendency, and it was something I put on my list of things to talk about, if you allowed me to. There's this assumption that you need some sort of value change in order to see significant policy change. In Canada, universal health insurance emerged during a period of a really intense Red Scare, and there was fear of communism on the rise.
Yeah.
There was a doctor strike in Saskatchewan. They had to call in physicians from the UK to come and fill in. Absolute pandemonium. And when I show this film to my students in a third-year class, they're absolutely aghast that this happened. They think it was just a smooth little transition. Everybody kind of sat around a table and decided that it was a good thing to do. In fact, and I think that's kind of an counterintuitive lesson that I would take, especially with what's going on in the U.S. You know, these kinds of changes sometimes occur during the most politically turbulent times. And my fear sometimes when I look at the U.S. context is that the conditions look too favorable, I guess, in some senses. So this assumption that if we don't get reform now under an Obama administration, then we're doomed to fail. Certainly there are differences in our political systems, there's no question, but I don't think people should assume that having an administration that's seemingly sympathetic is enough. And the counterintuitive is that, you know, sometimes out of these very intense political struggles can come about some really meaningful change. And I think that's what happened in Canada. Not everyone was sold on the idea, for sure. And it's something that really has evolved over the last 40, 45 years. In retrospect, people can say, well, Canadians support this, and it's a sacred trust, and it's a defining feature of our identity. Maybe it is, but it certainly wasn't when this was put into place.
Yeah. Thanks for the call, Carl. Paul is next from New Berlin, and we're about a minute left in time, everybody. Hi, Paul.
Yes, hi, good morning. It seems to me that we can't really have thorough health care reform in the United States without also looking at tort reform. It seems to me that many procedures and tests are done unnecessarily by physicians out of fear of malpractice and lawsuits. So I wonder if your guests can comment briefly on the incidence of medical error and the role of malpractice considerations in the Canadian system. I'll listen off the air. Thank you.
All right, thanks, Paul.
Yeah, and a great point. I mean, I don't probably have the time to sort of discuss it and give it its due time, but certainly the question of medical error has figured, you know, prominently in the Canadian context. We came out of a tainted blood scandal of the 1980s and 90s, certainly. So that's. But I think it's a little more intense in the U.S. context and generally than it is in Canada. That's not to say that we haven't grappled with some of those issues around medical error and malpractice.
And thanks for your call. Professor Orsini, thank you so much for being with us.
No problem. Thank you, Kathleen, for having me.
So well to us, and I'm sure you're a great teacher of this as well. Professor Michael Orsini, Associate Professor, Faculty of Social Sciences, School of Political Studies at the University of Ottawa, and he teaches courses on health policy and also on politics, explaining the Canadian system to us, the Medicare system in Canada. We are doing a series of programs looking primarily at how other countries, what kinds of healthcare programs they have in place. Next week, however, we will be looking at all the reform proposals that are afloat in the United States and take a brief historical look at healthcare delivery systems in the United States for, well, far back as you want to go. The next week, France, which has been touted as a model that people ought to look at. We'll also be looking at Mideastern countries and the Caribbean. So it should be an interesting series of programs as we debate this whole issue here in the United States. These will be on Tuesdays for the next few weeks at 10 o'clock. Thanks to Joloma Noel for producing this hour, and thanks to John Treader for on-air production in our Milwaukee studios for all of your calls. As always, thanks very much, everybody. Many hours of great conversation ahead. I'm Kathleen Dunn on the Ideas Network of Wisconsin Public Radio.